Your speaker is Claude Farr.
And the lesson today will be based on a passage in 1 Timothy. And if you'd like, you can turn to 1 Timothy chapter 3, and I'll be reading in just a minute verses 14 through 16. And the things that I say this morning will be based on that text. Timothy was a preacher, and he worked under the Apostle Paul. And at this particular point in time in which 1 Timothy is written, Paul had left Timothy in the city of Ephesus. And he wrote 1 Timothy to give Timothy some instructions as to how he was to conduct himself and some things that he was to teach and try to impress upon the people. So I want to read it this time from 1 Timothy chapter 3, verses 14 through 16. These things write I unto thee, hoping to come unto thee shortly. But if I tarry long, that thou mayest know how thou oughtest to behave thyself in the house of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and the ground of the truth. And without controversy, great is the mystery of godliness. God was manifest in the flesh, justified in the spirit, seen of angels, preached unto the Gentiles, believed on in the world, received up into glory. Now, I want us to look at that text this morning. There are three basic things that I want us to observe, notice that stated in this text. First, I'd like you just to look at the expression, the church of the living God. It's chic in our generation, in fact, for the last two or three decades, to speak disparagingly of what people sometimes term the institutional church. And I'd just like to look at this passage this morning to kind of sound a warning that we be careful how we speak of the church if we're talking about the church of the Lord. And there are several things in verse 15 of this passage that help us, I think, to properly appreciate the church. Notice these two or three statements that are made. First of all, the simple expression, the church of the living God. We should never think of the church as being a human institution. It is not. It's God's church. And usually when people speak disparagingly of the church, they're thinking in terms of human beings. But that's the wrong way to think about the church. We need to always remember that it is God's church, and that's what the apostle is saying. More than that, he doesn't simply say God, he says the living God. Now, Timothy was in the city of Ephesus. Ephesus was the city where they worshipped the goddess Diana. When Paul was in the city of Ephesus preaching the gospel and they opposed him, the mobs in the city stood in the streets inside and cried, "Great is Diana of the Ephesians." Diana was a lifeless idol. And it seems that what the Apostle Paul is doing here is making a significant contrast. The church is not the church of a lifeless idol. It's not the temple of Diana. But the church in its greatness, he says, is the church of the living God. And we should have a great appreciation for the church for that very reason. Also in this passage, he speaks of the church as being the house of God, the family of God, not the house of God in the sense of the building and the brick and the mortar, not that, but the people. And the apostle refers here, as elsewhere in the scriptures, to the church as being God's family. You shouldn't speak disparagingly of the church, because when you do, you're talking about God's family. I don't like for anybody to speak badly of my family, and I'm sure you don't of your family. Well, God does not want men speaking badly of His family, and the church is the family or the house of God. And then the third thing that he says about the church here in this passage is that it is the pillar and ground of the truth. I don't know why Paul used that particular expression in this letter, but We might surmise that it's because of the city of Ephesus and the goddess Diana. There was a great temple to the goddess Diana there. And that temple was held up by massive columns. And if you were a visitor of that city and you wanted to look at the wonders of that city, you would stand and admire those pillars, those columns that held the roof and the structure of that great temple to the goddess Diana. Paul is just saying that the church is the pillar and the ground, not of a material roof, but is the pillar and the ground of something far more important, the truth. And in a world of false philosophies, in a world of moral decay, it is important to remember that it is the church that stands out as the voice that speaks for the truth. A lot of false things being taught in the world today. The dominant philosophy of the modern Western world is naturalism. And that simply is the belief that nature is all there is. And in a world with that philosophy, it is the church of the living God that says, nature isn't all. There is a God in heaven. A worldview that's very prominent today as a world is humanism. And humanism simply says that man is the measure of everything. It even enters into religion. In fact, within the last week or so, I was talking to a young man, a young college student that had some car problems, just happened to be talking to him, and we were talking about religion. And he was trying to decide what religion whether he wanted one of the Eastern religions or Christianity. He was sorting through the religion. We discussed it for a while. And as we talked, he said somewhere in the conversation something to the effect that he was trying to decide which religion was the best for mankind. Now that's humanism. See, he was not interested in God. He was interested in man was the measure. That is, and he didn't even know that until I pointed it out to him. That is the dominant philosophy in the world today, that what's good for man, that's the measure of everything. Very little thought, even in religion. Very little thought about God. It's mostly what it will do for me and for my fellow man. Relativism. Is another philosophy in the modern world. I read a book a year or two ago that an educator had written, and he talked about the college students that he observed coming into his classroom now as opposed to 30 years ago. And he said that the students that came into his classroom came from various backgrounds, and they were very different in their religious beliefs and in their moral outlook, very different, very diverse. But they all had one thing in common. Every one of them believed in relativism. That is, they believed there was no moral absolutes, nothing absolutely true, but everything was sort of relative. That's the dominant moral view of the modern world. Well, the Church of the Living God, in an age that believes that everything is relative, states that there are some things that are absolutely true and right, and there are some things that are absolutely wrong and not right. The church is the pillar and the support or ground of the truth. That's what Paul said in the first century, and that's just as true in the 20th century as it was in the first. But then there's a second thing that I want to look at in this passage this morning. I want to look at the statement, how thou oughtest to behave thyself. Now, in looking at that, we need to notice that he says, how thou oughtest to behave thyself in the house of God. He's not talking about general behavior. Of course, that's an important thing that we talk about in the Bible. But in this particular passage, when Paul talks about how to behave, he's talking about how to behave in the church. He's giving some rules, or speaking of some rules and regulations for the way we're to be as God's family. Want us to notice that he says, but if I tarry long, thou mayest know how thou oughtest behave thyself in the house of God. In the church, in the house of God, there is a standard. It's not just anything goes, but God has set down some rules for how we ought to behave ourselves. And look at verse 14, he says, "These things write I unto thee, that thou mightest know how to behave thyself." For two chapters, chapter 2 and chapter 3 of this book, the apostle has been giving some rules and regulations for how things are to be conducted in the church of God. And he's just saying to Timothy at this point in his writing that I'm writing these things to you so you will know how to conduct church affairs. Now there are several things in those chapters, and we won't look at all of them, but we'll notice a couple of samples. In chapter 3, starting out, he says this: "If a man desire the office of a bishop, he desireth a good work." And then he starts talking about a bishop. He says that he is to be a husband of one wife. He says he is to be one that ruleth well his house, having his children in subjection with all gravity. "For if a man know not how to rule his own house, how shall he take care of the church of God? Not a novice, lest being lifted up with pride he should fall into the condemnation of the devil." Have you ever had two young men come to your door, knock on your door, and introduce themselves as elders? Most of us have had that experience. What's wrong with that? Well, what's wrong with that is, that's not the way it's supposed to be in the church of God. Because here, just these few verses that I read, you can see that the elder of the church is to be a mature man, a married man, a family man, a mature man. That's one of the regulations that are given for the church. And Paul has said, after he's written that, that Timothy, I'm trying to tell you in these writings how to conduct church affairs, how people in the church are to behave, how it's supposed to run. That's what he's talking about. Now, there's one regulation that he gives in chapter 2, verses 11 and 12, that I want to especially mention this morning because it's very significant in our day and age. This is how it's supposed to be conducted in the church. "Let the women learn in silence with all subjection. But I suffer not a woman to teach, nor to usurp authority over the man, but to be in silence." Now we practice that here. We don't have women preachers. We do not have a woman teaching the adult congregation, auditorium Bible class. We don't do that. We respect this. But I wanted to mention that this morning, and I think it's important to mention that, because we live in a day and age in which there's a lot of effort being made to overturn it. And even within the church of our Lord, there's some voices that are raised up that are suggesting that women ought to take a place in the Lord's church, contrary to what I've just read in this passage. What Paul is saying in these two chapters, chapters 2 and 3 to Timothy, is here are some regulations for the church. And these things I've written unto you so that in the church you'll know how people are supposed to behave, how you're supposed to conduct church affairs. And we need to be careful as God's people to make sure that we never cater to the whims of the age and cast aside the rules and the regulations that God has laid down for His church. But then there's a third and a final thing that I want us to notice this morning from this text. He says in verse 16, "And without controversy, great is the mystery of godliness." Now, of course, you don't want to miss the whole connection here. He's talking about the church of the living God and its greatness. He's telling Timothy how to behave himself in the church of the living God, which is so great. And he's saying that the church of the living God is the pillar and the ground of the truth. And then he's saying that this mystery of godliness, this truth, is tremendous. It's tremendous. And so he says that without controversy, great is the mystery of godliness. Now, don't let the word mystery throw you. In fact, in our class upstairs, we were discussing that word this morning. Mystery in the New Testament is not something that you don't understand. But mystery in the New Testament is something that once was not understood, but has now been revealed. And so it's like if you pick up a mystery book, it is a mystery at the beginning, but when you read all the way through it to the end, you know. And it's no longer a mystery to you. It is revealed because you finished the book and you know how it comes out. Mystery is used in the New Testament is talking about a mystery that was not known in ages past. the mystery of godliness. But it is now known by us. And what the apostle is saying here concerning that mystery, that message of Christianity, he says, great is the mystery of godliness. We have, and we should appreciate it in the church, we have a tremendous message. And there is nothing like it in all the world. Sometimes we are so familiar with the main tenets of Christianity, we grew up with it. And it's just old hat to us that we might not thoroughly appreciate the greatness of the mystery of godliness. What the Apostle Paul is trying to do here is to emphasize just how great it is. Now, he doesn't tell us everything about it, but he names six things. Let me just read those in verse 16. And without controversy, great is the mystery of godliness. Number one, God was manifest in the flesh. Number two, justified in the Spirit. Number three, seen of angels. Number four, preached unto the Gentiles. Number five, believed on in the world. Number six, received up into glory. Now, we won't comment on all six of those, but just notice the first and the last, because those two, perhaps more than the others, present the greatness of the mystery of godliness. God manifest in the flesh. The incarnation. The virgin birth. You ever heard a greater story? Is there anything more marvelous than the concept that the God of all creation came to this earth and became a man? And then he ends, received up into glory. You remember the story in the early part of the book of Acts? The apostles were there with Jesus on the mount, and as they looked, he ascended up, and the clouds received him out of their sight. And then the next chapter, Peter tells us that what happened after he went through those clouds, that he went on and he sat down on the right hand of the majesty on high. Great is the mystery of godliness. That's what Paul is saying here. The Christian message is a great message. Notice the expression he said in the first part of the verse. And without controversy. It just means nobody will deny that. Even the people who do not believe the Christian message will not deny that it is a marvelous story. In fact, there are some people who do not believe in Christianity, and the reason they don't believe, they say it's just too great to be believed. It's too marvelous. It's what Paul is talking about when he says without controversy. Nobody with any reason at all could read and understand the story of Jesus Christ, God becoming flesh, and then the ascension into heaven, and say that was not a great story. That's what he's saying. Without controversy, great is the mystery of godliness. Now, I was reading this and thinking about this. I just kind of, as I do sometimes, reflect on things. And I thought, you know, man in his imagination has really tried to come up with and has come up with some amazing things. I remember as a kid, the big little books we used to read? Some of us remember the big little books. I remember in Tarzan of the Apes, one of my favorite stories. Of course, it didn't start in the big little books, but, you know, that's an effort of an author, man's imagination, to come up with a fantastic story. A baby raised by the apes, and then as a grown man could go through the trees like an ape. Amazing story. And then, of course, there is Superman. Superman, the spaceship that crashed, and the boy that came out and was raised, but then became Superman. Remember that story? Coming a little closer to modern times, there is the Bionic Man. And of course, in Star Wars, we kind of marvel at the Force and things like that. What is that? That's all efforts of mankind and his imagination to come up with marvelous things. But you know what? There is nothing that surpasses the story of Christianity. We've heard it so often, we know it so well, that we might not think about that. But the story of the mystery of godliness is that God came down and became a man and lived and then died as a man and then ascended back up to glory and is seated right now on the right hand of the majesty on high. It's a true story too. Those others are fictitious. But this is a true story. And even man in his imaginations with fictitious stories cannot top it. That's what he's saying. Great, without controversy, great is the mystery of godliness. And we need to remember as the church of the living God, that the truth, that the message that we have to carry to the world is the greatest message that's ever been presented, and that man in all of his imagination could never conceive of a greater message. God became a man, lived on this earth, and then God ascended back into heaven and is seated on the right hand of the Majesty on high. Christianity has a great message. Great is the mystery of godliness. To believe the greatest message the world has ever heard. But more than that, this gospel message is a saving message. In Romans chapter 1 and verse 16, Paul said that he was not ashamed of the gospel of Jesus Christ because he knew that it was the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believed. We're inviting you to believe the great message of the mystery of godliness, the greatest message the world has ever heard. And we're also inviting you to be saved by that message, by the gospel of Christ. Now what you need to do is believe. You need to believe it. Repent of your sins. Confess your faith that Jesus is really the Christ, the Son of God. And then be baptized for the remission of sins. And you'll become a Christian.